God save the state of Texas in this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has four causes on its oral submission documents. The order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Coastal Corporation and Others versus Jorge Garza and Others from Oasis County. Harold Caldwell versus Robert F. Barnes from Hidalgo County. N. Ray Bay Area Citizens Against Lawsuit Abuse on Original Mandamus Proceeding. And Linda Gail Austin versus Health Trust Incorporated from Horton County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral arguments. Petitioner or relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and complete these arguments before we take our lunch break. The arguments are being recorded by our clerk, and you may make application with the clerk to purchase a tape of any of these arguments if you desire to do so. Justice Hankinson is recused from the first case. We're now ready to hear argument from petitioners in Coastal versus Garza.
May I please support Mr. Lloyd Powers will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 6 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. May I please support? Even more than usual, I'm delighted to be here to make this argument this morning. The fatal flaw with this certification is that the plaintiffs are trying to use a procedural device, class actions, to change substantive tort law. They can't possibly meet the requirements of Rule 42B4, predominance, superiority, manageability, without substituting group causation for individual causation. In Bloyd, Your Honors held that the requirements of Rule 42 have to be scrupulously observed in order to protect the rights of absent plaintiffs.
Are you arguing on behalf of all the petitioners? Coastal, Citgo, Hess, everybody?
Well, I represent Coastal, American Crane, and Citgo. Hess is part of this appeal. They're still part of this appeal. They've asked not to give their argument and to have us make their argument for them.
Well, at some point, we're going to want to ask questions that go to just to some of the petitioners, but not others.
Well, I represent American Chrome, Citgo, and Coastal.
All right. You may proceed with an argument as to the whole case.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. What we have here is the flip side of Loya. The requirements of Rule 42 also have to be observed to protect the substantive rights of the defendants. Now, the plaintiffs here have alleged three torts: trespass to land, nuisance, and negligence. The substantive law of these torts requires the plaintiff to prove a particular kind of harm to his or her property. This isn't just an issue of defenses or damages. It's part of the plaintiff's case on liability. If an individual plaintiff in this case sues multiple defendants, that plaintiff has to show a causal link to each defendant individually. He can't establish liability against Citgo by showing he was exposed to Coastal's emissions. Or he can't show liability against Coastal by showing that Citgo's emissions reached his land.
How is this case different from RSR?
Well, RSR was a single source, and our case is a multiple source, long-term exposure case. But it's similar to RSR in the following way. In RSR, the court clearly held that a class could not be certified, because certifying a class would preclude litigation of showing that individual pieces of property were connected to the defendant. That issue is exactly the issue in our case.
What about the significance the Court of Appeals put on the personal injury claims in that case?
Well, we don't have personal injury claims in our case, and that's a factual distinction. But individual causation is not an invention of personal injury cases. It's true in all tort cases, property damage cases as well. And that's exactly what RSR held. RSR had a property damage claim, and the court held that the plaintiffs were required to show individual causation between their property and the defendant's source, even on the property damage claim. So the general principle is individualized causation rather than group causation, and that's as applicable to property damage claims as personal injury claims.
Wouldn't we have to overrule some of our prior cases to find a conflict between these two decisions?
I don't believe you would, Your Honor. All of the Texas jurisprudence requires individual proof of causation. Consider, for example, market share liability. The court has rejected market share liability in Golding. Individualized proof of causation is what we're putting before the court, and I think that's a deeply embedded principle in Texas tort law that would not have to be overruled.
Professor Powers, before you get further in your argument, help me to understand the issue of mootness and the rights of the party to dissolve the class. As I understand it, the plaintiffs have moved to decertify the class. That's the relief you're seeking here. Why is it not? Why can't you just allow the trial court to proceed with the plaintiff's request to decertify the class? You won.
Well, if the trial court decertifies this class, that will not end our disputes with the plaintiffs. They'd like to make you think it would, but that would not end our disputes with the plaintiffs about class certification. If they decertify the class and deprive this court of the ability to make a ruling, deprive us of our appellate relief that we're seeking from this court, that is, that a class certification in this case is inappropriate. If they deprive us of that ruling, they can turn around and recertify this class or move to recertify this class tomorrow.
They've been candid about that. They said they would.
And they said they would. They still are seeking certification against one of my clients, Citgo, to enforce a settlement against Citgo's objection. So they're still trying to certify a class in this case.
That's for the purpose of collecting a settlement from Citgo.
But under terms that are contrary to the terms Citgo agreed to.
What have they said about recertifying as to Coastal?
Well, we moved specifically as a cautionary device in the trial court. We moved that if the class was dissolved, it would be dissolved with prejudice, that it would not simply be reasserted and reestablished shortly after this court loses its jurisdiction. And they said no. They filed a pleading just yesterday, in the Corpus Christi District Court and said they oppose our motion to make their decertification with prejudice.
And did they indicate that they would ask the trial court to recertify as to Coastal?
Well, that's all Coastal asked, is a promise, is in the order that they would not be able to recertify. And they said yesterday in the pleading they opposed that motion. The every indication is they wanted to certify this class against us, and the only reason they are moving to decertify the class or dissolve the certification order in the trial court is to keep this court from making a ruling and deprive us of our appellate relief. They said that in their pleading.
Has the trial judge given any indication of how she might view a motion for a recertification?
Well, she hasn't, Your Honor, but if we were to lose that, we would have to go through the appellate process again. We've been deprived of our appellate relief. And one of the things that many, many courts have talked about in terms of class certification is that the mere certification of the class drastically alters the settlement posture of a case. And in fact, that's what's happened in this case, right? We've had a certification hanging over our heads. It drastically alters the settlement posture. We want appellate relief to get out from under them. If it goes back to the trial court, we're going to have to go through that whole process again.
In this case, I believe the trial court certified some subclasses. Now, do you oppose the certification of any of the subclasses?
Yes, Your Honor. We do oppose certification of the subclasses. The subclasses, and I'm just, the subclasses here, if I may, Your Honor, here are the industries. The three classes run east-west in these three zones, and then they're divided into five-year subclasses. Those five-year subclasses are totally arbitrary. They have nothing to do with when there was diminution to property values, when there were incidents at any of these plants. For example, their claim is there's a diminution of property values. That diminution of property values did not happen all at once. There's no baseline that they did. People who bought early may have had more diminution of property values than people who purchased late in the process.
Let me ask you this. Is your position that each of these claims needs to be tried separately?
No, Your Honor. Our position is that these claims have to be tried in a way that protects the substantive rights of the defendant. To dispute whether there is a causal link between an individual defendant and the particular piece of the plaintiff's property. That can't be done in a class action, but there are other aggregate methods of adjudicating these claims. And in fact, that's exactly what the Manual on Complex Litigation that's put out by the Federal Judicial Center calls for. That is, there can be other forms of aggregate litigation. There can be consolidations for discovery or for trial. There can be bellwether cases. We can try many of these cases as bellwether cases, make settlements on that basis, or find out that their theory here, that the mere presence of industry, diminishing property values, that mere theory, which is not a tort, doesn't have anything to do with emissions reaching particular pieces of property, we might find out that there's no liability there, and then the case goes away. But we can litigate with some advantages of aggregation. We can litigate individual issues of causation in bellwether cases, consolidated cases, without a class action.
Back on the jurisdictional issue, the chief asked you a question a while ago. I think what he was getting at was conflicts jurisdiction. And would we have to overrule any of our prior case law?
I'm sorry, absolutely. I thought, in addition, in my answer to Justice Abbott, I mentioned RSR. I thought in addition to RSR, no, absolutely. RSR stands for the proposition that even on the property damage claim, there has to be individualized causation between a particular piece of property and the defendant's source. That's what we're arguing here. Each individual defendant says, I want proof, I want to litigate individual causation between my piece of property, between our emissions and your piece of property. If that case would have to be overruled if this class is certified.
Not just distinguished.
That principle, that holding in RSR would have to be overruled.
But we talk about it being so far, so close on the same facts that one could not come up with a distinguishing principle. And that's been our standard, right or wrong.
There's nothing to distinguish that principle. Every case, Your Honor, can be distinguished at some level on the facts. If that's the standard of conflicts jurisdiction, there will never be any conflicts jurisdiction. The principle that was necessary for the holding in RSR was you can't use a class action to substitute for individualized connection between a plaintiff's piece of property and the source. That principle would have to be flatly overruled to certify.
Why would we not also have to overrule Avalos? If I'm pronouncing that correctly. Yeah, Avalos.
You wouldn't have to overrule Avalos.
You don't think that we would have to reevaluate the standard?
I think what Avalos is saying, which is a perfectly appropriate standard, you can't simply create conflict jurisdiction by finding dictum in a footnote in the case. Say there's something that this court said that's inconsistent with that dictum. We'd like the Supreme Court to clear it up. In RSR, the particular reason for the holding, even if the case can be distinguished on the fact, the particular reason for the holding, individual causation, not group causation. That is exactly the principle we're putting forward here. And it's exactly the principle that the Court of Appeals ignored in
on your argument of individualized causation, how is that principle not applicable across the whole spectrum of class actions? If the principle in this case was that for nuisance you have to have particularized causation, therefore you could not have a class action, how does that not apply virtually in all class actions where a defendant or multiple defendants would always allege, listen, you've got to particularize the causation. You can't do class action that way.
Well, first of all, there are class actions in commercial cases, in antitrust cases, where once somebody's in the market at all, the causation issues are trivial. In mass tort, multi-source tort cases, we are urging that it is difficult, if not impossible, to ever meet the requirements of Rule 42B because of this point, and we're not alone on that, Your Honor. That's exactly what the court in Amchem, the U.S. Supreme Court in Amchem said. That's exactly what, see my lights aren't going to finish the answer. That's exactly what the Fifth Circuit said in an excellent opinion by Judge Higginbottom in Fiberboard. You've got to have individualized causation. It's exactly what the Fifth Circuit said in Castano.
Those are all personal injury cases?
It's what the court said in Murphy Oil, which has property damage cases. But all of those cases do say that it is, and it's not us inventing this principle, all of those cases, and including the manual on complex litigation, say that because of individualized causation, class actions are not an appropriate way to handle long-term, multi-source, mass tort cases, whatever they may be in a consumer fraud type of case. So yes, we are saying that this is not a device, especially compared to bellwether trials or consolidation for handling multi-source mass tort cases, and we're not alone on that.
Can you explain, though, or if you like the procedural posture of the TICO settlement right now, there was an agreement, the ad litem came back and made certain recommended changes.
The ad litem recommended changes and the settlement as being enforced, as the plaintiffs are trying to enforce it, is with those changes. So the settlement is what with...
And the trial judge has approved the settlement with those changes and put those changes in before?
Well, as tentatively approved sending out notice to certify a settlement class. So they're in the process of certifying a settlement class. And that, again, to the mootness point, shows that there still is a dispute about these classes. At any rate, the settlement is not complete. CIPCO objects to the settlement, and it would simply be on different terms than CIPCO agreed to.
Is that what the problem is with that? They signed an agreement, both the CIPCO signed an actual agreement, but now the ad litem changes on material, so that's a counteroffer, so to speak.
Your Honor, I don't know whether they signed or came to other agreement with the plaintiff, but the terms of that settlement have changed in a way that it is not enforcing the original settlement.
Why would this scenario not work? And that is for us to abate this particular appeal, have it go back to the trial court for two determinations. One is to see if CITGO could be held to the settlement agreement that they voluntarily entered into. And if the court approves that class settlement, then CITGO would have gotten what it wanted. Then two, see if the trial court would dismiss with prejudice the class certification such that Coastal and any other non-settling defendants would not thereafter be subject to any class certification other than perhaps a settlement class, which could only occur if the parties agree.
Well, two problems with that, Your Honor. One, if the settlement class is enforced against CIPCO, CIPCO is going to be right back here asking for that to be, that's not appropriate for class certification under the same arguments we're making here.
But even if the terms of their settlement agreement hold true, like the 90% aspect and everything else, not the modified settlement agreement, but the original settlement agreement that they entered into?
Well, that's purely hypothetical. That's not what the plaintiffs are asking to do. So we don't have a proceeding in the trial court. We don't have it would not be possible for the court to abate the proceeding here and send it back to the trial court to proceed on that. That's not the proceeding in the trial court right now. There'd have to be another motion. The plaintiffs would have to bring some other proceeding in the trial court to do that. The other problem is, it's our view that these multi-source, long-term, mass tort cases are not appropriate for class action. We'd like to have that resolved. It would be, I think the court does have jurisdiction. It would be far better to get that resolved. And then when we go back to the trial court, we know the ground rules. And we can start to resolve this case. We can start to agree on bellwether trials. We can maybe try a few of the cases seriatim and see how it goes, as has happened in many mass tort cases. We're simply delaying the process if we do that.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear arguments. Please respond.
May it please the court, Mr. Lee Godfrey will present arguments in response.
Please, the court, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, and Justice Owen, Justice Abbott, Justice Phillips, these appellants are asking you to overrule your prior decisions to resolve this case on the basis of an alleged conflict between the decision of the Court of Civil Appeals in Corpus Christi in this case and two cases, Amoco v. Hardy out of Corpus and RSR. The sole basis of jurisdiction of this court over this interlocutory order is this alleged conflict that they claim between this decision below on the interlocutory appeal and the decisions in RSR and Amoco v. Hardy. If there is not a conflict within the meaning of the decisions of this court, including particularly the Gonzalez-Arado case, the Christie case cited therein, the old Dixon v. Southwestern Bell case, all of which is the law of this court. If these people, these appellants, don't meet the standard set forth by this court about what it takes to show a conflict for purposes of conferring jurisdiction on this court over the appeal of an interlocutory order, they're out of this court.
Let me ask you this.
And they are out of this court.
Tell me what's wrong with this theory for basically conflict jurisdiction in the class action context. And that is that in RSR, under the facts they had in that case, some of which are similar to what we have in this case, the court decided not to certify. Then you add on to that facts we have in this case, such as opposed to that case, we have multiple defendants. As opposed to that case, we have multiple different types of what I call chemicals. There was lead, here it was various other things. There were only one method of exposure. Here I see at least two methods of exposure, counting the groundwater. Considering those things, the things I mentioned are, I would consider to be even more compelling reasons why class certification should not take place. So the argument would be that since class certification was not allowed in RSR, with these other factors, which seem to mitigate against class certification, and for the Court of Appeals to hold that class certification would be valid, that would be a true conflict in the extreme against the holding in RSR.
Two reactions to that, Justice Abbott. One, what conflict jurisdiction is about is indeed, do you have a case that is so on the same state of facts that a decision in the one case necessarily involves an overruling of the decision in the other case? You can't get to that. You don't make that analysis on the basis of whether the court applied the correct legal principles or different legal principles, although that was the argument you just heard. You get to it by looking and comparing the facts of the previously decided case with the case at bar, number one. Number two, there are just as many, if we want to start potting them up, differences between RSR in this case that militate against applying an RSR result to this case, as there may be factors, as the court suggests, that would say, well, this is even an easier case than RSR. Therefore, we ought to say, notwithstanding that we don't have the same state of facts, it's conflict. And before I move on as a footnote, that might be an excellent argument to make to the Court of Civil Appeals in all due respect, Justice Abbott. But it is not the issue before this court, and it's not the basis of this court's jurisdiction. In RSR, we had
personal injury claims and all the attendant individualized issues that a lot of courts have talked about, including the Murphy Court in Louisiana, that they make a great deal of in their brief, that lots of courts have had trouble with in the class context, including the Castano case, the smoking case in New Orleans, including Ancam, the asbestos. RSR, if you read the opinion and you read the facts, that court was plainly occupied, if not preoccupied, with the problems attendant to the personal injury claims in that case. Not here in this case. Two, the facts, and it's the facts that we have to look at when we're looking at the issue of conflicts jurisdiction. In that case, it was undisputed by the plaintiffs that over 70% of the class area had received no deposits of lead from the smelter. So the plaintiff was asserting a class overlying a geographical area, 70% of which had no damages, undisputed. That is absolutely not the state of facts in this case. The record in this case, and let me say something about the record in this case, since someone mentioned Boyette. We had a hotly contested adversarial class action hearing before Judge Pate in Corpus in this case. We presented factual testimony from recipient witnesses. We presented expert testimony, all of which to show Judge Pate that in this case, we have shown and we will show that emissions by each defendant diminished the property values of each property in this case. You've heard an argument essentially on the merits here about how you just can't have a class action in a toxic tort case, and certainly you can't have one if there's more than one defendant. If because you just can't show, as a matter of law, and I ask you to look and find any of this in RSR, the alleged basis of the conflict, because as a matter of law, a class cannot demonstrate class-wide injury tied as a matter of fact to the acts and omissions of each defendant.
I take it from your argument that if we were to send this back to the trial court to decertify as to some defendants, you would recertify or ask the court to recertify as to Coastal.
Justice Owen, we might and we might not. I am not prepared to agree to their motion, which says that we will not and that we will dismiss all class allegations against Coastal and American Chrome. And certainly, I will never agree. They also made that motion, as I recall, on behalf of CITCO, which entered into a settlement agreement with us.
But focusing on Coastal, what are you going to do about
on
Coastal if we send this back?
If we send this case back, Your Honor, two things will happen. Hopefully, CITCO will honor the contract that it entered into and will be able to send out the
I'm
notice.
I'm talking about Coastal. What are you going to do about
that? That will leave, as unsettling parties, Coastal and American Chrome. Hess is in the process of reaching a settlement with us. I expect it to be concluded very shortly. They're not arguing here today. And counsel who stood up and argued, in my understanding, is not arguing on behalf of Hess. I expect that settlement to be concluded shortly. We will have then, Justice Owen, a situation where we will have recovered for the class the $31 or $32 million in settlements that we have achieved, including the CITCO settlement, and we will have Coastal and American Chrome left. If indeed we are unable to consummate a settlement with those two companies, we will indeed probably will be obliged, in fact, to continue to seek recovery on behalf of the class against those two companies. I cannot ethically, in my judgment, simply say I will dismiss with prejudice the claims that we've made on behalf of this class against Coastal and American Chrome.
Given that that's the case, are you then saying this court should decide on the merit either there is conflict or there's not conflict, and if there is a conflict, then go to the issue before us?
Mr. Chief Justice, I'm saying that this court should withdraw its granting of the application as being improvidently granted for lack of jurisdiction.
Okay, but if we found their jurisdiction, what I'm trying to isolate is, do you say that your dismissal of at the trial court level of the Coastal class, or of certification against Coastal, moots this proceeding?
Moots this proceeding, Your Honor. Absolutely.
And how many times could you do it? Could you get 50 class certifications, and if it were appealed, you could dismiss them and there's no appeal?
Hypothetically, or wanting to continue
you get one free bite, or five, or what?
Your Honor, the reason, and believe me, it was not an easy decision, but it was the only way that we felt we could protect the settlement that we had reached with Sitka, would be to move to decertify in the trial court this previous certification, so that would, and that is what they are claiming as a basis for why they don't have to perform their settlement agreement. So that's the reason why we did it. They agreed to pay in round numbers $17 million to this class,
but
including
you could
a buyout.
Sever Sitka and leave the class. You could sever Sitka out and go on. I mean, theoretically. You wouldn't have to decertify Coastal.
But, Your Honor, Sitco is an appellant here, and they are claiming that they don't have to perform their settlement agreement.
I'm focusing on Coastal.
Okay.
You could theoretically...
Yes, we could.
...sever and go about your business with the settlement, however that's going to shake out.
We could.
And proceed against Coastal without decertifying it. Because we're right back where we started. If you don't reach a settlement and you ask to recertify, they have to start the appeal process all over under your theory of the case.
If the class were decertified as to Coastal, pursuant to our motion in the trial court, if that happens, and if we are able, as I believe we will, to hold Sitco to its settlement agreement and go ahead and get out notice, along with the defendants who are not participating in this appeal and want their settlements to be concluded, if we could get that done, we would have a decision to make concerning whether we would seek again to have a certification hearing as to Coastal.
And Chief Justice Phillips, there's procedural and jurisdictional issues. How many times can you certify and decertify against someone like Coastal and evade appellate review of that certification decision?
Technically, I suppose, Your Honor, you could do it multiple times. It's a procedural rule. It's a procedural device. It's an interlocutory device in the trial court, just like a lot of other things that get done and undone in the trial court. Obviously, it involves the judicial process more than most interlocutory orders do, but I don't believe there is any legal impediment to not one, but two or three certifications in the trial court. Now, as a practical matter, would it happen is a very different question.
Let me ask you a question to help me understand the facts and the law and how to apply the law to these facts. You're trying to enforce the agreement that Sitco made with your client.
Correct. Correct, Justice.
But in that agreement, Sitco expressly reserved the right to challenge the certification order.
But did not make the settlement contingent on any action by this court on that appeal,
But don't they have a right to continue to contest the certification order because they expressly reserved that right?
So long as they continue to perform their settlement agreements.
But they seem to be contradictory.
Not necessarily, because one thing that's going on, in my judgment, is a desire by some of these defendants to make some law. that has nothing to do with whether or not they're going to perform their settlement agreement in this case. Their settlement agreement is not contingent on whether or not this court grants or denies the application or the action this court takes on the application.
They can pay the $17 million and continue to appeal and try to make some law. Is that
absolutely.
Essentially,
why is that a lot of controversy?
Well,
why wouldn't we have jurisdiction over that?
Judge, that's their position. That's what I would say is the most generous description of their position. I don't believe that, in fact, a proper construction permits them to decide on the day before preliminary approval of the settlement agreement they signed that they're not going to perform it and that they're going to come
up with this. Well, they say this, they haven't agreed to this, that the ad litem made material changes for recommended material changes in the settlement and that they didn't approve it.
I'd like to speak to that, Justice Phillips. Thank you, sir. What the ad litem did is require the attorneys to reduce their attorney's fees and to put more money in for the class. Any additional funds came from the other settling defendants.
Don't attorneys think that's material?
It had nothing to do with the amount of money being paid by Citgo, Justice Phillips. There were no changes ordered by the court as a result of the guardian ad litem's advice and our several conferences with her and the guardian that affected Citgo 7. All Citgo has done is, instead of performing their settlement agreement, they have announced to the public the day of the preliminary approval hearing of their settlement. They announced to us the day before that they didn't intend to perform it, is that they are going to buy out one of the neighborhoods that's included in this class. They're going to do it without the restrictions in the settlement agreement as to what use that property can be put. And they're going to do it without paying the cash in addition to the buyout that they agreed to pay in the settlement agreement. That is what Citgo, in fact, is doing. They repudiated their settlement agreement with no legal basis to do so. They refused to comply with the restrictions in the settlement agreement on what could be done with this property after it was bought out. And they refused to put the cash into the settlement agreement that they agreed to put in.
So, in essence, you're saying Citgo has no standing to challenge these changes. The ad litem recommended and the court agreed may be going to agree to because
absolutely.
It doesn't change their position.
It doesn't change their obligations at all. What they're doing is not in compliance with their obligations under the settlement agreement.
Mr. Godfrey.
Yes, sir.
Are you aware of any authority out there on class action where the damages that are claimed are purely economic damages and courts have applied this argument of the defendants here that particularized causation trumps the class action concept in a purely economic damages case?
No, sir. No, sir.
Now, they relied on Murphy, and you made a brief reference to that. Does Murphy have anything other than pure economic damages in it?
Murphy's got personal injuries in it, Your Honor. Okay. Murphy had a, as I recall the facts in the Murphy case in Louisiana, it had a so-called air class and a water class. And interestingly, what the Murphy court said, and this water class, quote unquote, was a group of people who lived along this lakefront in Louisiana, whose houses were around this lake. The claim was that the defendant company had been dumping toxic chemicals into the lake and it interfered with their property around the lake, as I recall the case. This may be the Willett case that's cited in Murphy, and I'll apologize if that's true. But the Murphy court discussed a class where all the people suffered simply economic damages, if you will, property damages, and talked about how that class could be certified.
Well, I misunderstood. I thought
there is
no
argument
that Murphy was referred to as a case where there was economic damages, not personal injury, but I misunderstood.
I am aware of no decision in Texas, certainly, and frankly, nowhere else that says that you cannot have a class action of property owners who are suing for purely economic damages or diminution in property value period.
So the problem with the RSR in this case's conflict really is fundamental to the issue that's raised, is whether or not the individual causation trumps class action in a case where only pure economic damages are being alleged.
That's one problem with the Justice Senate, for sure.
And the RSR had personal injuries, which there's been a lot of cases that have indicated that's not an appropriate case for class action.
Correct. RSR court talked about children playing in the yard and people gardening and how this would affect their personal injury claims, and the court spent, I think the RSR decision, what it stands for is that where you have these kinds of personal injury claims, that the court there decided they could not certify because of a lot of the same reasons other courts have reached the same result. Your Honors, if this court, as I believe it,
you need a question.
You were about to say.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. If this court, as I believe, on the authority of Gonzalez, Dixon, Christie, withdraws its order granting this writ for want of jurisdiction, and this case goes back to the trial court, and the trial court understands that, which right now maybe she doesn't, but would like some help, that under Rule 43, she has indeed the jurisdiction, notwithstanding the proceedings in this court, to dissolve the order appealed from, going back to your very first question, Justice Phillips, which I think she plainly does have the jurisdiction to withdraw the order appealed from, which is the certification on the merits. She does that. We will be able, in my judgment, to conclude at that point. I know we have the settlements concluded with Southwest, with Champlin, with Oxy. We will have it done with Hess. We'll be able to get the Citco settlement done. And I will represent to the court in all probability that we will certainly not be seeking multiple merits certifications as against Coastal. We are not prepared to agree to their motion, which says we should dismiss with prejudice all class claims against Coastal.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. I'd like to make some specific responses to some things the plaintiffs say. But I do want to note that they spend very little of their time defending on the merits of this certification. That this case ought to be certified as a class action. There was some talk at the end of that, and I'd like to address that.
Let me ask
in
a real
bit.
Quick question about the merits, assuming we would get there. Would you refresh my recollection about what happens in the comparative liability statutes if Coastal and American Chrome are the only remaining defendants?
Well, there's a problem of American, if I could, Your Honor, just preface that by saying there's a problem with, well, what if American Chrome and Coastal are all that's left, or maybe Coastal is all that's left. That does not turn this case into a single source case.
No, I agree. I mean,
it still has
what
individual issues of causation.
What findings would you be entitled to from a jury on comparative liability?
Well,
against settling defendants.
Well, we wouldn't be entitled to either a sliding scale credit or a dollar credit against the
defendants. So you wouldn't have to get apportionment findings.
But we would have to get apportionment findings between us and the plaintiffs. And for every defendant that is left, we'd have to get apportionment findings between us and those defendants. If American Chrome was left, I represent them here today, but American Chrome and Coastal will be at odds with each other in that trial. So we would have to get findings on the comparative negligence issues. But again, this would not be a single source case, even if there was a single defendant left. I would like to address Justice.
Before you do that, a minute ago you said there were alternative ways to dispose of these claims, but it seemed to me what you were saying is we try 10 and that will dispose of the 2,000, which seems to me then a reason why it perhaps is a valid claim.
But in those 10 individual suits, and that's exactly what the Manual on Conflict Litigation called for, in those 10 suits, we can litigate individual causation between individual defendants and that piece of property owned by the plaintiff, or diminution in property value.
And then that would apply to RESPA claims?
Not a, well, some courts have applied estoppel. Many bellwether cases have been successful in then giving the parties a view of how to settle these cases, and that's exactly what the manual on complex litigation calls for. But in those cases, individual causation can be litigated. I'd like to address Justice Enoch's point on the difference between personal injury and economic damages. Their model is presence of industry, reduced property value. That's what Martin Smith testifies to. That's what they want to say gets away from the individual issues of causation. There is not a tort that says negligence causing pure economic loss is recoverable. That's the economic loss rule. Right? So they've got to show economic damages from a trespass to land. Trespass to land requires tangible stuff to go from an individual defendant and injure the plaintiff's land. So that this is not a pure economic loss.
How does it smell?
Well, smell could be a nuisance. Between trespass to land and nuisance is the difference between tangible and intangible invasions like smell.
So
but they've got to show
their
smell on their land.
But if the evidence is such that the prevailing wind comes from the northwest and blows it to the southeast across this property, couldn't you design a class with subclasses for property that's closer and property that's farther away based on a model of how the smell dissipates and greater damage is closer and less damage is farther? Didn't that...
Well, but Your Honor, if I can use the map for a moment, some people in the class are over here, near Sitka. Some people are over here near Catalina. It may be that all of them are affected. We just want to be able to litigate that. We want to be able to say, you over here were not affected by Sitko's emission. We just want to litigate it. That's not the merits of the case. Mr. Godfrey says we're trying to litigate the merits of the case. All we're saying is we want the case to be litigated in bellwether or individual suits where we can litigate those issues. If it's a class, we can't possibly litigate those issues. And their substitution for saying, well, we all had reduced property values. Reduced property values simply under substantive law is not a tort. They've got to show an invasion of their property interest. They allege trespass to land, nuisance, and negligence. Those are not merely economic loss torts. Let me turn briefly to the mootness question. It's put quite directly. How many times can they do this? We're complaining about the class being certified. We come up and try and get relief, and they say on the eve of our relief, or what we hope to be our relief, they can simply dissolve the class, go back, and start over again. If that doesn't interfere with our appellate remedy and this court's jurisdiction, I don't know what does. They say there's a procedural rule, a procedural device that they get to use that says the trial court can dissolve the class. The trial court can do a lot of things, but they've got to do them consistent with the other parts of the rule. The rest of Rule 43 or 29, whichever is applicable here, the rest of those rules say they can't enter an order, any kind of order, an order to dissolve the class or any other kind of order that would interfere with this court's jurisdiction or interfere with our appellate remedy. And if they going back and coming up and going back and coming up doesn't do that, I don't know what does. And finally, Your Honors, on the conflict jurisdiction. Rule 42 and the predominance requirement does not just apply to personal injury cases. And it doesn't require looking at the merits of the case. Castano, Murphy, and Ken all say you at least have to look at the nature of the case. That's not a personal injury issue. It's not a property damage issue.
I have one time more question. How about Sitko
settlement? Oh, thank you, Your Honor.
Sitko has standing even to complain that there's a different,
that
there are changes in the terms.
Next on my list, Your Honor, I appreciate the question. It is true that part of the new settlement has involved some attorney's fees being put back into the class. But those attorney's fees, there are different classes here. There's a groundwater class, there's airborne classes. changes what different people in different classes get, and it will change the releases.
So what? But Cisco's liability does not change.
It does change, because the releases to Cisco...
More money? Are they going to put more money into the settlement?
No, they're not going to... Well, we don't know whether... They're not going to get the same releases as they would have with the money they were putting in before. And so the settlement isn't as valuable to them. Because there's one part of the release, if I can, again, Your Honor, one part of the release is about buying this groundwater area in the Oak Park Triangle. But there are other classes as well. And it's my understanding of Citgo's position is that to get that money to satisfy some of the classes, it may not or put at risk the settlements with the other classes. And therefore, the protection that Citgo would get would not be the same for the same amount of money.
Is that explained in your briefing?
Well, all of this, Your Honor, has come up after our briefing. We would be happy to further brief that issue with the court.
But that settlement hadn't been enforced, so that's not in front of us, technically. I mean, no one has tried to enforce against this.
No, but we're here because Citgo is objecting to a settlement class for litigation purposes or for settlement purposes. It is the plaintiffs who come back and say, well, Citgo's a bad guy because they're just reneging on their settlement class. And what we're saying is they're not reneging on their settlement class. It's a different class. Mr. Godfrey then said, it's not going to cost them one more penny. And all I'm doing is responding and saying, well, it's going to alter the settlement. You know, what you pay in is one part. What releases you get back and how good those releases are because money has been moved around is quite a
bit. Well, let's step back to first principle. Let's suppose Citgo has settlements, it's all been approved, the notice is sent out, you're paying out money right now. But as part of the settlement, if you provided that you could come up to this court and get an opinion as to whether that class was in
right.
good anyway, would that be a live controversy that we could decide?
Well, we think there's still a controversy about the class. I don't. And we think it would preclude the plaintiffs from objecting to us going forward with this appeal. For them to say part of the settlement is we can go forward with the appeal. For them to
It would not preclude the court from wanting to see the documentation and deciding that indeed this was Fletcher versus Peck.
Well, I agree with Your Honor that we can't simply by agreement confer jurisdiction on the court. But we are a long way from an agreement. We have a real dispute.
I understand. But if
and Coastal has a dispute aside from all of this.
But if there was only one settlement and the ad litem had come in and said it was great and it was in the process of being executed, then clearly this court could look at those documents and decide that there was not a live controversy. Correct?
Well, the controversy before this court isn't the propriety of the settlement.
But, I mean, if it's going to be settled, there wouldn't be anything for us to decide that would affect the parties.
If both parties, I'm trying to answer the question, but if both parties came forward and said this is going to be settled tomorrow, but we'd like some opinion to give us guidance in the future, I agree that would be different. If I don't think this court would have the jurisdiction to decide whether the settlement was the same or different. That's for the trial court. And as long as that's a live dispute, whatever the merits of that dispute, as long as that's a live dispute, and Citgo is objecting to it being done as a settlement class, then all we're doing in this court is objecting to the settlement class part.
But there's a possibility that the trial court might enforce the settlement agreement as written if she decertifies.
If she decertifies, but then we would be back here on two issues.
That's a different appeal.
Well, part of it would be a different appeal. The part that objected to enforcing a settlement against us that was not the original settlement.
I'm saying she goes back to the original settlement and enforces it as written. That's an option for the trial court.
That's an option in the trial court, but Citgo is still going to object to a class. Now, when the Citgo's agreed to the plaintiffs not to do that, is a different matter. But there's still the question of whether it's proper to have a class under those circumstances.
We have just two issues here in this appeal, conflict issue and whether the class was properly certified. And if all of them settle out, those two issues are gone. And so the appeal is moot.
Well, there's no indication of coastal settlement here at all.
But in my mind, it's some confusion about who's doing what, when, and where.
Yes, Your
Honor. A lot of the discussion has to do with matters that are purely in the trial court now and cannot be before the court on the record we have. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I agree with that, Your Honor. We are not coming forward saying the settlement is before this court. When I was sitting here, I heard us getting beaten up by Mr. Godfrey for reneging on this settlement. And I'm just saying that's not true.
Well, I understand your position, but what either one of you say about that is not before the court.
Correct.
Any other questions?
Well, a couple of quick ones. One is that the scope of the stay voluntarily entered by the trial court concerns only staying a ruling on decertification of the class, or is it broader than that? And then secondly,
that's my understanding.
And is it your understanding that the trial court will maintain that voluntary stay until such time as we issue an order or an opinion?
That's what she's indicated in her order, that she is waiting a ruling from this court.
Okay.
Anything further? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the argument in the first call. Thank you.
All right.